Well, this is a classic story with a classic ambition and a classic instruction, very instructive for us as devotees. Well, it's instructive for everyone, but it especially highlights the fact that someone who wants to do something separately from the will of the Lord, his endeavors will ultimately be fruitless. We have to, of course, give Hiranyakashipu some credit because at least he's performing these austerities in the mood of karmakanda, that he's approaching a demigod. His activities are regulated. It's explained that when you've... This karmakanda, by the way, is the first step of the yoga ladder, the ladder of perfection. So it's acceptable because by these regulative activities of sense gratification, one becomes detached. And from detachment, one gets knowledge. From knowledge, one seeks the instructions from the Vedas. And from the Vedas, one acquires self-realization. And from self-realization, one attains faith. However, although that is accepted, this karmakanda as the first step of the yoga ladder, in Hiranyakashipu's case, his mentality is demoniac, so therefore it's refruited. What do you say? Refruited. It means he disqualifies himself. He's disqualifying himself because not only does he want to lord it over the material nature, he wants to lord it over the complete material nature, even up to the point of taking Lord Brahma's abode. And his intent is also demoniac because he's not a devotee. He doesn't desire to be a devotee. He doesn't even wish to enter into that arena of devotional service. So therefore, Hiranyakashipu is acting on the platform of false ego. Krishna explains, prakriti kriyamanani guna karma vibhagasaha shradava bhajate yomam kartaham iti manyate, that the spirit soul, bewildered by the influence of false ego, thinks himself the doer of his activities, which are in actuality carried out by the free modes of material nature. The influence of false ego, the definition of false ego, comes in three categories. Number one, I am the greatest. Number two, I am better than anyone else. And number three, I don't need anyone else's help. This is the sum and substance of false ego. So we can analyze, even as devotees, whether we have false ego. We all have false ego. But we can analyze to what degree that false ego is there within us by analyzing these three. I'll say them again. That false ego is determined by three principal misunderstandings. Number one is that I am the greatest. Number two, that I'm greater. I'm greater than anyone else. And I'm better than anyone else. And number three, that I don't need anyone else's help. So it's not that just because we become a devotee we are freed from that. In fact, of course, it's something that happens to us alongside our practices, even from day one, that Krishna's program is to get rid of the false ego. But usually the larger amount of false ego is got rid of in a more progressive stage of our devotional service. In other words, Krishna tends to take care of our immediate material problems first. We come to Krishna consciousness with these material ambitions. So he likes to take care of those first, so that we're at least nicely situated in devotional service. We have a place to sleep, we have a place to eat, we're eating nicely, we're sleeping nicely, we're associating with other devotees nicely. It's the ABC of Krishna consciousness. And what happens later on, of course, is that the false ego starts to be worked on in a very classic and dramatic way. And mostly, I would tend to say that 99.9% of the devotees leave Krishna consciousness at that point. That the false ego is being worked on, and it's very, very painful. The internal aspects of Krishna consciousness. And of course Krishna, he knows exactly each individual devotee, and he knows exactly how each individual devotee is going to be freed from, either freed from false ego, or his false ego is going to be further inflated. Anyway, back to Aranyakashipu, his false ego is not going to be deflated, at least at this point. He's adamant about his determination to, number one, take over the universe, number two, to be immortal and have no opponents. So he basically wants to be the best, the truly only best person within the universe. So that's one great false ego. What he doesn't know is that whatever he does is actually being governed by the modes of material nature. There is one nice story which Hari Suri mentions in his diary, which is very relevant to this point, where people are struggling against the superior arrangements around them. And it was one morning when Hari Suri was about to massage Srila Prabhupada. It was in Vrindavan outside his room in the courtyard. And as he lay the mat down, Prabhupada sat down on the mat, and suddenly there was a noise of a sparrow who was engaged in making a new nest. And Prabhupada had mentioned that the sparrow the night before had been disturbing him while he was translating, and he asked Arisori to try to make some arrangement to fill up the hole where this sparrow was coming back and forth building its nest. So Arisori got some paper, he stuffed the hole with paper. When the sparrow came back, he saw what had happened. But instead of just flying off, going somewhere else to build a nest, he spent at least half an hour with great vigor and determination to remove the paper, which he did. He removed it, and then he continued building his nest. So then Prabhupada said, you will have to do a better job than what you did previously. So this time, Arisori, he got more paper, and he stuffed it in so intensely that it was just impossible for the sparrow to take it out. But the sparrow, not having very much intelligence, at least when it came back, he saw again what had happened, and he made his effort to take away the paper. After 15 minutes of trying, he flew off to get one of his mates to help him. So then they both came back, and they both, you know, with great determination and vigor again, they had a go at taking away this paper. And Prabhupada was watching all the time. So then at least 15, 20 minutes passed after bringing back his friend. They concluded it was not possible. And as they flew off, finally flew away, accepted defeat. Prabhupada, he gave a nice analogy. He said, people are very active in the material world, but just like these sparrows, they did not know that we were sitting there watching and stopping them from doing whatever it is that they wanted to do. He said, in the same way, material nature is doing the same. It's watching every activity that we do and making its own arrangement. So therefore, he points this out, that it's a hard struggle against the superior arrangements. We don't see material nature working, but material nature is working against us. It's working against us as long as we're against serving Krishna. Because Krishna says also in the 7th chapter, Bhagavad Gita, text 14, Devi Esha Gunamaye Mamamaya Dharataya Mameveye Prabhyante Mayamite Dharantite. This divine energy of mind consisting of the free modes of material nature is very difficult to overcome. But one who surrenders to me can easily cross beyond. So he's pointing out that even though it's the inferior nature, it's still divine. It's divine. It's something that we cannot overcome unless we have Krishna's permission. And this is why we're taking shelter of Krishna in devotional service. Of course, the modes of material nature, even within the life of a devotee, is still prominent. Again, it's not that we put on dhoti, kurta, and tilak, and then the modes of material nature are no longer influencing us. They will continue influence, making its influence, providing we have, as long as we have this false ego of as I explained previously. As the false ego is dissolved through devotional service, then gradually the modes of material nature back off. First it's the mode of ignorance, and it's the mode of passion, and then at some point the mode of goodness will also the mode of goodness will go towards will also disappear, and Maya then will go to Radharani and say, "See that devotee down there? He's good. He's been able to overcome the influence of the modes of material nature." And then, of course, Radharani will ask, will inform Krishna, "You see your devotee down there? He or she has managed to come out of the modes of material nature." And at that time, Krishna instructs the modes that you leave now my devotee alone. You leave him alone. He or she has worked very hard, has become freed from the influence of false ego and the influence of the free modes of material nature. So now please desist from your influence. So this is what Krishna says: if one surrenders to me, then you can overcome this divine nature of mine and easily cross beyond. We have to cross over somehow the ocean of material existence. This ocean is vast. It's not such a small ocean. It's so vast that it is not possible to cross beyond it unless we have Krishna's favor. When we have Krishna's favor, he reduces that ocean. As explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that ocean of material saga is reduced to the point where you can easily cross beyond it. In other words, it mentions the hoof print, the calf's hoof print, which has water in it. And that is something which is very easy to cross. You don't even actually have to think about it. It's something you do effortlessly. You don't even think about it. You just cross beyond it. And this is the position of a devotee who's overcome the free modes of material nature. It is his devotional service is performed effortlessly. It's almost as if you don't even have to think anymore. How am I going to do this? When am I going to do it? It just automatically happens. Because Krishna is intervening at every moment. Krishna confirms this in the Bhagavad Gita, that when the mind is controlled, the super soul is already reached. Meaning that as long as the mind is not controlled, then the super soul does not intervene with your activities. The super soul is just observing. This is also explained in the Bhagavad Gita, that there are two birds sitting in a tree. One is the one who's trying to enjoy, the other one is the super soul who's looking on. At the point of controlling the mind, the super soul starts to intervene with that person's life in such a way that his activities in devotional service starts to become so easy that there needs to be no effort involved. Of course, there's always some degree of effort, but it seems like that even a little bit of effort, then Krishna makes his presence so that there's not an extensive effort required. So always there's some effort needed. We must always be vigilant in our devotional service at any point in time. Prabhupada himself said that I'm always praying to Krishna that I don't fall down from devotional service. So he mentioned that that time that we should pray in such a way that we should pray in such a way that everything depends on Krishna, but act in such a way that everything depends on us. So there's no point in time where we can say, well, I don't have to do anything anymore because Krishna is helping me. We always need to be vigilant as long as we're in the material world, possessing a material body. But at least Krishna is confirming here that I will make things much more easier for you. All you need to do is to give up your false ego by taking shelter. There's another story in this connection regards to the position of a devotee and the position of the non-devotee. And this story is the story where in the Mahabharata, just before the war took place, at the same time, both Arjuna and Duryodhana, they decided they would go to Krishna and ask for Krishna's help. At that time, they were arranging all the kings of the world to either be on the side of Arjuna or the side of Duryodhana. But whose side would Krishna take? Would it be the side of Arjuna or would it be the side of Duryodhana? So they both went. It was almost classic in the sense that they both thought of this idea of accepting Krishna. Of course, Arjuna, he didn't just think. His intention was anyway to have Krishna on his side. But it so happened that they both arrived in Dwarka at the same time, although Duryodhana happened to arrive a few minutes before. So the gatekeepers at the Dwarka fort, they ushered Duryodhana in through the gate first, and then Arjuna came just a few moments afterwards. So they were both escorted to the room where Krishna was. He was at that time lying down, sleeping. And immediately Duryodhana waited at the head of Krishna and Arjuna waited at the feet of Krishna. Arjuna was in pranams, just looking at Krishna's lotus feet. And when Krishna woke up, he first saw Arjuna and then he saw Duryodhana beside him at his forehead. So then he asked them both, what is it that they have come for? And immediately Duryodhana said, well, I want you to be on my side during the war. You're very charitably disposed to everyone. You're equal to everyone. So since I arrived first, then my claim should be granted that you please... you and your army, please accompany us on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So then Krishna said, well, actually, you may have come first. You may have entered the room first, but when I woke up, I saw Arjuna first. So I think that he should be given the first option. And besides that, from the Vedic stanzas, it is said that the youngest person should be received first. So I'm going to ask Arjuna, the first question will be, do you want my army or do you want myself? So immediately Arjuna, he said that he didn't want the army, but he wanted Krishna on his side. And of course, Duryodhana was very happy about that. He was thinking that Arjuna? Was it just acting sentimentally? And with a smile on his face, he asked Krishna for permission to leave and thanked him for his army. So the moral, of course, is that although the army consisted of, I think it was 10 Hakshayini, which was quite a large army, although materially speaking, you know, Duryodhana, he superseded Arjuna in that deal. It almost seemed that for Arjuna, it was a little bit of a raw deal, that all he got was Krishna, and what Duryodhana got was a whole 10 Hakshayini army. But in retrospect, what Duryodhana did not understand was that no matter how much material facilities or opulence you may have around you, if you don't have Krishna's blessings, then you will not be victorious. And it's explained in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita all the reasons why Arjuna would reign victorious. And of course, one of the main reasons was that Krishna was on his side. Because when Krishna is on one side, then the goddess of fortune is also there. So not only would there be victory, but there would also be opulence. Other reasons mentioned by Srila Prabhupada why Arjuna would reign victorious was because what are the other reasons? The Kurukshetra is a holy place, yes. Kurukshetra is a holy place, a Dharma Kshetra, Kurukshetra. That anything done in a holy place, then if you're a devotee, then whatever you do will be successful. If you're not a devotee, it will not be successful. So the fact that Dharma was going to be established and those who were devotees, they would be victorious. Anything that contained adharma, asat, then there is not a question of being any victory. Any other reasons? There is a few more. Dharma, yes, he's following the truth. It's also mentioned that on the chariot of Arjuna, Hanuman's flag was there. That was an indication also that they were reigned victorious. There's a few others I don't remember, but I just mentioned that. Right. Yeah. So anyway, from the material point, the point is that from the material point of view, it looks like a raw deal. But and of course, Duryodhana, because he's not a devotee, he's thinking he's getting the best deal. But the purport, of course, is that no matter how much material opulence you have around you, if you don't have Krishna, then that same material opulence and will be the cause of your downfall. And there will be a great struggle for your existence in life. So Arjuna, therefore, being a devotee, he was not intelligent enough to know that, well, at least Krishna, if I have Krishna on my side, then I have victory, I have opulence, and I have the blessings of devotees like Hanuman. And I'm fighting for the ultimate principle of establishing Dharma. So, anyway, in conclusion, we see here that Hiranyakashipu is not a devotee. He's a non-devotee. His purpose is a demoniac purpose. His intentions are impossible. You cannot be immortal. Brahma himself, he points this out, that you're asking for too much. Even I am not immortal. I one day will have to die. And of course the point that he wants to enjoy the universe. But when Krishna says, A Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punera Vartano Arjuna Mamu Petya Tu Kauntaya Puna Janma Navidyate. From the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest. All our places of misery where repeated birth and death are taking place. Well, one who attains to my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So this is a very clear instruction. We are safe providing we take shelter of Krishna. It may be difficult. In essence, we're doing the same thing every day. It seems to be laborious it almost seems that we don't have very much freedom. But the freedom is actually coming. Freedom is coming to us on a daily basis, although we don't see it. Whereas for the non-devotee, he may see that he has so much freedom and independence. He's cornering himself. He's being cornered at every moment. And more and more he engages in fruitive activities for sense gratification, and the more he's trapped, he's bound. So Krishna says in all respects one should be a yogi, should be a devotee, and engage in Krishna consciousness activities. So I'll stop there.